This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The year is 1985, where two successful teen films under his belt, writer and director John Hughes, renowned for his knack for blending humor with teen angst, dabbles deeper in the teen fiction and fantasy realm with two unpopular high school teens, Gary and Wyatt, who are socially awkward and struggling with their lack of popularity and fail at all attempts to be accepted by their peers. Their desperation to be liked leads them to create a woman on their computer, and the result they could never have anticipated, for the computer creation turns into a living, breathing, gorgeous woman, Lisa, whose sole purpose is to boost their confidence level by putting them into situations which require them to act like men. Lisa's challenges push Gary and Wyatt's life into utter chaos and may be more than they bargained for. This week on Back to the Balcony, we dive into 1985's John Hughes film, Weird Science.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
All right, so this one was one of those I didn't see till probably, I think, seventh grade. I think I actually watched the TV show before I saw this film. This is one of those movies, even with 16 Candles, Breakfast Club under the belt, this is one of those unknown realms in my household where you take two high school students that create a gorgeous woman on their computer. It puts a question mark whether or not that's going to be suitable. It's going to put a question mark whether that's going to be suitable for the common household. So, but I think I saw it at the perfect age to really appreciate not only the relatability, but seeing the gorgeous Lisa in front of two teenagers that just added to that curiosity of being a teenager. So, but I'm curious because I know you've hinted at it. Hinted at this movie before. What are your thoughts?
Love it. This is one of my favorite John Hughes movies. And you've heard me talk shit about John Hughes in other episodes. Let me clarify. I'm not a huge fan of the false sentimental John Hughes movies. So Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink, like those scripts, they're fine. They're 80s movies. I like them, but they're not at the top of my heap. Favorite John Hughes, hands down, Ferris Bueller. Second place, Weird Science. I like it when he gets a little bit madcap and crazy because, to me, that was more sincere in its writing, right? He was writing through the eyes of a teenage boy, where I feel like 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club, Some Kind of Wonderful. I'm not against men writing for or through the eyes of women or teenage girls, but there is sometimes like a lack of sincerity that doesn't really mesh well with me and the message is trying to convey, because 90% of the time it ends up going the guy's direction anyway, and it's like that princess factor, right? Like the Disney princess fantasy kind of thing. So that's why I'm not super into those John Hughes movies. But Ferris Bueller and this one, I mean, those are two movies that when you are that age and you're anticipating becoming a teenage boy, these are the kind of like teenage fantasies you want to have, right? You want to create a woman in your computer that will like be a genie in a bottle, essentially, or you want to be the coolest guy in school that can get away with murder and take a day off and essentially raise havoc on Chicago and be praised for it. Like those were the teenage fantasy movies of my era, of that 80s and 90s era. And this is high up there. And I love that it's just nonsense. Like, I love that he was able to step away from the kind of pseudo-serious yet sentimental and funny teen comedies and just go out nuts with like a sci-fi fantasy film.
I agree with your ranking on this one because this one is next to Ferris Bueller's, my second, because it is chaotic and even more so the messaging of the delivery of not necessarily the female aspect of it, not necessarily taking a day off from school. But both of these movies have something in common that I think a lot of teenagers can relate to, is wanting to be relevant and wanting to be recognized. We saw that in the attention-driven Ferris Bueller dancing in a parade. We see that these two just not getting along with their peers that have to have a symbolic symbol of a female to really get what they really want, is just to be acknowledged and by their peers and to have that other happiness. And I think that's what Hughes does well when recognizing that. This one is a little bit more chaotic than what we've gotten from 16 Candles or The Breakfast Club, obviously, but this is a genuine John Hughes coming from experience from a teenager to an adult, what maybe he wanted. So it's not so fluffy as we got from 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, but absolutely it is bonkers, and it is something that can appease to the teenage mind. So to me, I absolutely love this picture. I love how it's handled, and I love the fact that the messaging just doesn't stop at a sex symbol, but what the sex symbol represents in a teenage mind is much, much more. And our critics are going to say that, where the term sex symbol, which, yes, it is, but there is a deeper meaning in this comedy psyche than what I think our critics reckon.
I also think that Weird Science and Ferris Bueller have a lot more in common than people give credit for, because I've always looked at those two films as Lisa and Ferris are essentially fantastical characters, right? They really are. Like, Ferris is essentially the Lisa of that movie. I've always said that Ferris Bueller's Day Off is Cameron's movie, because Cameron is the one that has the self-discovery and the self-realization and the full character arc, where Ferris is essentially just Ferris all the way through. And at the end of the day, he gets away with it. I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole of Ferris Bueller is Tyler Durden Fight Club situation that everyone likes to talk about. I don't buy that. But thematically, there is something there in the sense of, like, Ferris represents what we all want to be or wish we could be, and Cameron represents who we are and what we are and how we can feel better about ourselves. That's what Wyatt and Gary represent in Weird Science, and Lisa is that Ferris Bueller character that gets them out of their shell. Same story, different catalyst, different way to get there. And by doing that, you can have that same theme that was so recognizable and appreciated by teenage boys and young boys like us when we saw this movie, but you can have very distinctly different characters that are the catalyst for that to happen. And they're both zany, they're both outlandish, they both kind of break the laws of physics in a sense. They break the realm of storytelling of, are we living in a world where it's three-dimensional and we can touch, feel, and taste everything, or are we taking that extra step where there's almost like a metaphysical part to it, where Lisa is beyond reality, and in a sense, Ferris is beyond reality too. Hughes did that perfectly, and I wish that we would have had a little bit more of that and less of the sentimental stuff that he was, you know, really kind of known for. Ferris and this one are kind of like his outlier movies, right? And they just happen to be my two favorites.
Well, and as we see the progression of Hughes, we see him start to kind of do the generic comedy, which end up a couple of them being classics. But this is where he is absolutely real, and it's believable in an outlandish scenario. Because even if we take Wyatt and Gary, these are two contrasting, but contrasting nerds. You have the sex-crazed, lazy school student, then you have the computer nerd. These are two that really found each other to kind of go up against wanting to be recognized. They're relatable in their own unique way. And what I really did appreciate about the little chef's kiss that Hughes puts on to the Lisa character is he doesn't treat this character as a genie. The premise is a genie, but this is a computer program that is evolved into reality that is meant to challenge our nerds to do better, to become more oneself. And to that is relatable even more today than what it was in the 80s, because there are so many pieces of technology. There's so many social stresses. There are so many challenges that we lack having our young youth be challenged in that certain way, is to go up against social situations, as Lisa puts to our to boys here. So to me, there's an appreciation that is unrecognized in this movie at the time it was released, because not everybody was tech savvy. Not everybody realized the full potential of accountability when it comes to how to raise teenagers. So this is a Lisa character that almost acts not necessarily as a sex symbol, but a parent figure to really push their teenagers into the next level. So that is a Hughes that I think puts his parental hat on, and he also puts his inner child in. It's a good kiss of both elements that really does make this this movie really work.
Well, and I also like the fact that it's kind of a bait and switch, because what you just described, which is the way I see the movie too, can only be recognized and appreciated if you actually watch the movie. Because if you watch the trailers and if you just go by the plot synopsis, the generalization of the movie is that these sex addict kids create the perfect woman who fulfills their wildest dreams. That's it on paper, but you have to watch the movie and understand it. One of our critics didn't. Of what you're saying is that, in a sense, they've created a conscience. They've created a consciousness that helps them grow out of these shells they've locked themselves into, and it allows them to appreciate who they are after they've been what they think everyone wants them to be. Anthony Michael Hall was kind of like lightning in a bottle, but he was restrained by the characters that were written for those films, and I feel like this was the film that Hughes was like, okay, now be the guy who we see on set cracking people up. Be the outlandish kid, the weirdo kid, because you're going to create a persona that people are going to want to emulate. And it's not something I've written. It's something that I'm literally writing lines for you as a person to deliver. And that's how it feels. And that's why I feel like it's his best performance and it's his most sincere performance.
It's a believable performance. And this is the one where I think it takes Michael Hall into a teenage boy, because he really just kind of word vomits a lot of stuff that teenage boys would say. We can even see it in the montage of them creating the Lisa, where he's not tech savvy, but he's given opinions of once what his fantasies are, what his visions are. And when it comes to the relationship with Wyatt, there's no censor to him when it comes to women always being on the brain or his inner thoughts. So to me, I think this one, without adding any additional fluff to the dialogue, he is raw and he is a teenager. And this, compared to even 16 Candles in the Breakfast Club, this teenager speaks more like a teenager than I got out of the Breakfast Club or 16 Candles. So it is a great performance, but it also is, again, well written by Hughes on what is being said. It is from the male's point of view, and there is nothing wrong with that as long as it's genuine and it's real, and it's just not vulgar dialogue after vulgar dialogue. But to me, there is reality to it when it comes to what he's saying, and it's realistic.
I mean, like one of our critics calls it toilet humor and potty humor. This is the way I look at it, is there is a sincerity, and one of our critics recognizes it in the way that the dialogue's written, but also how freely Anthony Michael Hall was encouraged to improvise. For example, the scene in the Blues Club was all improvised, and you can tell, and it's hilarious. It might be like the funniest stuff in the movie. What I relate it to is it's like when Clerks came out, and all of a sudden, Kevin Smith was able to show the world what like the slacker voice was, right? Like, this is what people talked about in like middle class, lower class neighborhoods when they were at work and they were hating life and they're just pushing buttons and handing out change, but there's a sincerity to the dialogue. So people speak that way in those environments, right? It's vulgar. They're going to look over their shoulder before they tell a dick or a fart joke. And that's what this film represents. And our one critic doesn't recognize it because he doesn't like the package that it comes in. So I think that Hughes is really interesting in the fact that he was an amazing guy to capture the voice of youth, especially in a film like this and in Ferris Bueller. But also, there was a lot of kind of, I don't know, I'm not going to say fuckery, but he was really good at like pulling the veil over people's eyes and creating very stereotypical teenage characters in films like 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, but knowing what words to use to make them not feel so stereotypical. So this film being more raw, I think, definitely is clear in its sincerity of how he was as a writer and a director.
There are boundaries that these two have that really interact with each character differently based on the personality. And the danger we run into 80s comedies is the dialogue and the performances treat each other the same. And this is what I love about Wyatt interacting with Chet, is it's completely different than what we get with any other character, from the Lisas to the love interests. So every character is going to have a unique piece of dialogue where it keeps our interest, and we kind of wonder what that interaction is going to look like next. And again, the second half of the movie kind of goes bonkers with it, but I think this movie is the most special when you have those interactions with the entire cast. So we can see these characters kind of show their personalities through interactions with the other character.
It's interesting because the way I look at it too is like also like a metaphor of the parenting styles that were dependent on the social class of these families, right? So for example, Wyatt and Chet, their parents are very, very wealthy. They live in essentially like a mansion. They've got all the toys. They've got the best cars, but they're absent parents. The parents are always on trips. They're always gone. They're at the golf club, stuff like that. So Chet essentially is the stand-in parent for Wyatt. And that's why he does have like this kind of like, I own you. You give me all your allowance money, blah, blah, blah. In a sense, he is teaching Wyatt what it's like to be raised in a capitalistic society, because all Wyatt knows is what his parents just give him and leave him alone. But Gary, on the other hand, has very, you know, middle class, I'm not gonna say blue collar, but more attentive parents, more strict parents. And that is why he is more outlandish and outspoken, is because he has to rebel against something, where Wyatt has nothing to rebel against because his whole life is catered to, right? That's an interesting character dynamic for these two to be friends, and how they create that is by having them just both be social outcasts at school, where really, like, they're cool guys, but they're not cool for school. And Lisa is what kind of brings them out in that. So, yeah, I think that's the other thing, too, that we forget about, is that although there aren't a lot of parent interactions in this movie, they set up what the parenting techniques of these kids' families are like, and that is why the way they are, and why Lisa is kind of like the springboard into self-discovery.
And I love the fact that they don't focus on the parents that we get in so many teen comedies or dramas, if you will, because even I find the Gary character and the relationship between the parents very interesting, because we see this in movies time and time again, where we look at the sexual awakening with teenagers, and we look at it with the stricter the parent, the more horny the teenager. So, right. And I find that not, it's hinted at, but it's not focused on, but I think it's an unwritten rule that we just kind of look at and we already understand. We don't need to revisit it, that we've seen in movies past. And it's one of those that they make humor from it. That is probably, in my opinion, one of the funniest pieces of dialogue in the movie, when Lisa goes over there to take Gary to a party. So I think they have a lot of underlying messaging here that Hughes is smart enough to know he's not going to be repetitive, and he's not going to go down that route, because it's about these two characters and it's about the development of these two. So to me, that's what also makes this a very smarter, that's what makes this a smarter movie than what was given credit to at the time.
And Lisa is just a great character too. Like Lisa, I mean, it's so iconic. There is no weird science without Lisa. And even the show, which I think was a great TV show, Vanessa Angel was a great Lisa. Like she brought that energy where like there is a, there's a devilishness to it where it's almost sinister, but at the same time, she is looking out for their best interest. And sometimes the best interest is getting you into trouble. So you figure out how to get yourself out. Like that really is kind of like the moral of this story. Now, one of the things I thought was really interesting when I was watching the special features on the Arrow Blu-ray is they had an interview and a segment with Jackie Birch, who was the casting director of this film. She did all of John Hughes' movies. Originally, it was actually Robin Wright, Princess Buttercup herself, was cast in the role. She had the role. And it just so happened that a contract for a TV show that she didn't know she had was still valid. So she wasn't allowed to do the movie. So the next two people they brought in were Kelly LeBrock and Sharon Stone. Those were the last two people to audition. They auditioned together, and they went with Kelly LeBrock. It might be her most iconic role, you know, this and Woman in Red, but I honestly can't imagine any other Lisa but Kelly LeBrock in this. Like, she is the movie, in my opinion. I love Anthony Michael Hall, but Kelly LeBrock is the movie.
She's confident, she's sexy, but she's wise. She, even with the most simplistic dialogue here, she presents herself in an object that we want to look up to, with somebody with intelligence. And one of the biggest things that drove me nuts with the commentary of how this movie is viewed is the sexism of this, which we do get very tiny. But there's more to these characters. There's more to LeBrock than what people think. And those are the critics that are really looking at this at a surface level, because the way she holds and gives this portrayal is just utter confidence. And it's not confidence in looks. She flaunts that a little bit, but it's confidence in her ability to make one better. She is a computer program, and she flaunts that brilliantly. I agree with you. I can't picture, even though Vanessa Angel in the TV show was fantastic, this is a whole new level. This is not sitcom-y. This is, I need to get from point A to point B, and I need to keep with my portrayal of being confident, intelligent, and sexy, and she just nails it.
Well, she's 80s Mary Poppins, right?
Yeah.
Like, she comes in there, and she has the accent, she has the attitude, and she has, like, this all-knowing wherewithal that we just trust. It's almost like we feel like we can go anywhere, and even though it might be dangerous, Mama's got us. Like, that's how we feel as an audience, and that's how they feel, too. And she has to create mischief for them to understand that life isn't just being under the oppressive thumb of your parents or the bullies at school. Great bullies, by the way. Robert Russler and Robert Downey Jr. You know, I'm a huge fan of Robert Russler in movies. His role in Thrash, in one of my favorite 80s movies with Josh Brolin, too. And then Robert Downey Jr., like, this was like one of his first like 80s films that he showed up in. You and I have talked offline about Tough Turf and how much I love him in that, too. But that's another thing, too, that he was just discovered in casting. He didn't like get the phone call. He came in through auditions. Like, that's how he got into this role. It wasn't nepotism. It wasn't any of the stuff like that. He was found by a casting director for this movie. And slowly but surely, we see him rising up the ranks of the films of the 80s, where he can be like this little bully side character. But just that charisma, even as that character, got him the bigger roles later. There's just a lot of stuff in this movie that I think grew into better things. And we're sci-fi horror nerds, too. Giving us the winks and the nods of having Vernon Wells essentially dress up as his Wes character from Road Warrior, and then Michael Berryman, essentially in his Hills Have Eyes character, both show up as the mutant bikers. That is like a wink and a nod from Hughes to like the boys in the audience. And that's why I say this movie was such a boys' movie. He knew who his audience was, and I think he was wise enough to know who was going to be against this movie. And he kind of wrote that film around that audience, where it's like, you're going to say this is a sexist movie, but really, the most intelligent, powerful person in the movie is a woman.
It's a woman. And I want to go back to the Robert Downey Jr., because that goes to another brilliant piece of it, is creating the bully, which could make or break a movie like this, of making it too unlikable. It can ruin the laughs. It can drag the movie down. This is the bully that a lot of us can relate to. That's just kind of a skinny, scangly, just a douchebag. He doesn't have the muscles to really push people around, but he has just that unlikable annoyance to him that is believable. So I love, just down to the nitty gritty of that aspect too, is really brilliant. But I think holistically, here's what, if I were to pick one thing from this movie to take away that I really did enjoy, is the fact that this could have gone the route of being completely sexist. And what it does is take Gary and Wyatt in almost a respectable way on how they treat Lisa, because we even get that one scene towards the climax where they're wondering how to break the news to Lisa. They care about Lisa. They care about this character. And they never really treat her like an object, but rather the nervous teenagers that we see. you'll see like normal teenagers showering with them, whatever it may be. But there's a bigger picture of how they treat Lisa, and it's a level of respect. And that's what I really did like about the direction this went. It didn't go the route of every other stereotypical sex-filled comedy. It actually had value. And that's kind of the shame that you brought up in the beginning of the marketing of it, because that I wish I would have saw this a little bit earlier to an extent, because there is a lot of value to take away from this movie when it comes to morality.
These are horny teenagers, but then once they have come face to face with this woman that they created, which in a sense she could do whatever they want her to do, you can see where that like respectable parenting kind of comes into play, because it's not as much shame or embarrassment of being around her. It's a sense of respect and a sense of I do not want to misbehave in front of this woman because she is so beautiful and I can feel her power. And that's where a lot of people confuse this movie with like, oh, these are just horny teenagers that created a sex doll. And that's not what it is. And I like that. It's also like in that movie Losing It, where Tom Cruise is like the most sexually aggressive all talk, but then he gets to the prostitute and he's just a nice boy who can't go through with it. I like that because it does show that some people are all talk and they're actually different when the situation arises. And it's just, you know, the way we handle each other socially, right? And that's where I think Hughes was at his best, is when he wrote about that kind of social embarrassment and social accountability that most adults don't realize teenagers have, even though they were teenagers once themselves.
100%. And going into the last half of this movie, I have to say, I almost didn't need the chaotic events that happened towards the end at the house party to kind of prove the point. I honestly, that was the piece I disliked about it the most, because it went on a roll of these smaller situations. And I don't think we needed to go into this huge, let's create another woman to make ourselves popular, even though it was intentional to prove a valuable lesson. But there are so many situations that on a smaller scale that could have done that. And I think it kind of threw off the tone a little bit of the movie when it comes to throwing in too much.
Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of Joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
All right, well, so when it comes down to the critics' review of this, again, like, we've been kind of on a roll lately of them either having conflicting views or complete opposite views of what we think they should have in terms of appreciation of the movie. But I love this conversation because it's exactly what we're talking about right now, where one critic has a very staunch opinion on what he thinks a movie means, and then the critic that actually sees through it all. So Gene brought this episode to the show.
Weird Science, and for a lot of people, I think it's one of the most eagerly awaited films of the summer movie season, the late summer movie season, for two reasons. First, it was written and directed by John Hughes, who has made two very good films involving kids recently, 16 Candles and then more recently The Breakfast Club. And the other reason, at least that I've been looking forward so much to Weird Science, is its premise, which is that two kids managed to create, like modern Dr. Frankenstein's, a perfectly beautiful woman who will answer their every command. Sexist it may be, but it's still a cute idea.
So it's interesting to me that like he was a huge fan of the prior two films, 16 Candles and Breakfast Club. And we knew what those movies were. They're very similar in tone, and they're very similar in dealing with social classes. This one kind of does, but it's not the main catalyst of the stuff that happens in the movie, as that's what is the catalyst of those. Poor little girl, rich guy, whatever. I know that he likes the ideas of modern day horror and science fiction when on paper. You know, like, he liked the idea of Fright Night. He liked the idea of The Howling. But when it comes down to the actual film, I still can't figure out what he was expecting or what he thought these movies were supposed to be or should be. Because when it comes down to his actual review, all he says is like how much of a wasted premise this is. Like he said that in so many episodes that we've covered. It's like, great premise, but they wasted it on a trash film. I just don't know what the guy expects in movies like this.
I don't think he knows what he expects from this movie, because even in the last sentence that he says doesn't make sense to me. It's sexist, but it's a cute idea. So to me, those two shouldn't go in the same sentence when it comes to reviewing a movie. I mean, even when we're talking premise, the premise we've agreed is it's a unique premise at the time. But at the same time, for him, there's no way he can expect anything more. Maybe he was expecting just a silly comedy, but then he goes further that we'll talk about in a second, saying it's not the comedy that he wanted. Did he want The Breakfast Club or 16 Candles in a movie like this? Doesn't make sense. So there is no definition to what he's kind of describing of what he really wants from a movie about two teenage boys creating a sexy girl in a computer. So the only other route it could have gone is the silly, raunchy comedy route. So it just, this is the simplistic premise that you only really do have two forks in the road that you can really go.
And if he is a fan of John Hughes, he should have just trusted that John Hughes was going to take us down the path where at least the characters are going to be either likable slash redeemable, right? Like, that's kind of where it is. We're not supposed to like Judd Nelson's character in Breakfast Club right away, but we grow to like him as he has like a redemptive side to him. Like, oh, this is just the bad boy who's looking for attention, and that isn't necessarily what he needs. What he needs is to feel like he belongs in a group or belongs with a woman or a girl that's not an outlaw or a rebel like his. Like, leave the generational trauma aside and focus on what people really want from you. But granted, that relationship ends after 2 days. I honestly believe that. I don't believe the end of Breakfast Club is a happy ending. That's just my opinion. But anyway, he goes on.
I was stunned, actually, by how little was done with its engaging premise. How little was done that was either imaginative or funny or surprising. The film winds up insulting women and our intelligence with an awful lot of foul-mouthed toilet humor. Now, when we get to the party, the film really falls into the dumper with violence and ugliness and stupidity. And even the character of the perfect woman, and boy, you could do a lot with that character changes because she turns out to have really a mind of her own. She's not just the boy's creation. She wants to teach the boys a lesson about life.
So I don't agree with any of that right now because, again, we've always said this. Gene doesn't know how to get on the fun bus. This is a comedy, and it's fun. It's one of the most fun films of the 80s. And he looks at all of the hot points of it, like, well, because they built the perfect woman in a computer and they were fluctuating the breast size, that's sexist. Or the way that everyone's drooling over her and they want to be like Wyatt and Gary because they're hanging out with this beautiful woman, that's sexist. I don't understand his point because I don't think he understands his point. I think that he just doesn't like the film. He doesn't like the ugliness of it. And so he's trying to use politically charged talking points to get his review across. And I don't buy it for a second.
I don't buy it either, because he obviously missed the entire point of especially what we're talking about. There is depth to this. And I think he went into it with the intent of exactly what the marketing wanted it to look like. And he's sitting there trying to look for all the things that the movie describes to be sexist, to be offensive. And we also look, even if we look at Gene's past, this is a man that went to private school that maybe didn't have the relatability to teenagers that that most may have seen in just normal high schools. So he might naturally have a hard time to really relate to these two characters. And to an extent, we even talked about it. Maybe it was so strict that he really wanted more sexual nature in this and he just didn't want to admit it. So it comes off as almost a argumentative disappointment that it didn't go far enough in the sexual realm for him. I can deep dive into the subconscious of Gene Siskel and what he wanted from this movie, because it really doesn't make that much sense on what he's describing. So that's the only tools we got, is to deep dive on the why Gene felt this way.
And it doesn't make sense either. Like, the dude's favorite movie was Saturday Night Fever. Tony Manero is like one of the worst characters of all time. He's sexist. He's misogynist. He's a manipulator. He's a bad dude. Yet he loved that movie and kind of idolized that character and that performance. It goes back to like the contradictory stuff. Now, I'm not saying that he has to judge all the movies based on how he feels about Travolta's character in Saturday Night Fever, but it also kind of hurts your credibility when you've been so self-proclaiming of how much you like that movie and how much you, I mean, the dude bought the suit at an auction. Like, it was his totem, was that film. And then you see characters that are actually like nicer characters and deserve a redemptive arc and they get it, yet he completely downplays it and kind of just, I don't know, puts down the false sexism of the movie, because it's really easy to say that. Yeah, because are there moments of nudity where there shouldn't be? Yeah, there are. It's an 80s movie. That shit happens. Are there women who are being treated poorly by their boyfriends? Yes. But that plays down the road later into why they end up with our leads and not the people they were with at the beginning of the film. There are so many redemptive arcs that he gives no credit for. He's focusing on the main talking point, which is Kelly LeBrock came out of a computer and these boys designed her essentially with the intention to have sex with her.
Well, not only that, but everybody, when she's on screen, they look at her. She's a beautiful woman, of course. But there's nothing wrong with that when it comes to the teenage eye. And that's what is missed. And that's what drives me nuts about how we view movies like this, is it's almost stereotyping a movie before you actually think about it. Gene, I can guarantee you, walked out of this movie with a rating in his hand, didn't even give this movie a second thought by the time he got home to see if this had a deeper meaning to it. And we've talked about this before. We walk out in an emotional state. We expected something. We got something different, and we don't know how to digest it. We don't know how to really analyze it. And that's what I think happened here with Gene, is he saw the premise. He saw the sexuality, a mild sexuality for the 80s, I might add. And he walked out saying, I got this movie pegged, because it is just a silly teenage comedy romp that has a sex symbol that went nothing with it, but missed the complete redemption piece and missed the complete sweetness of it. Because when it comes down to it, this is a sweet movie with kind of some thrown in elements that, yeah, you're right, it's an 80s movie. We're going to get nudity. We're going to get Bill Paxton as a toad. We're going to get a lot of these elements that are just silly and at times can distract from the overall messaging. But it's those that look deeper beyond the silliness that's really going to take something away. And all Gene saw was silliness.
But Roger comes in to save the day.
Surprise. You're going way overboard on this one, Gene. This is a funny movie, and it is an entertaining movie. I don't know where you get this about toilet humor, violence.
Let me tell you where.
I mean, I think you're way too sensitive.
First of all, I like foul mouth humor. The Last Detail is one of the foulest films ever created, and it was funny. So I'm now no prude on that. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you that the character of Anthony Michael Hall, the kid...
a wonderful performance.
No, that, I think he had a wonderful performance. He does the same thing over and over again, Roger, and that is...
Gee,
and
that's funny. You liked him in
I did
in
like him.
In Candles when he played the Wimp.
Yeah, he had a script. Here he has one toilet joke after another. If you took out every anal reference... If you took out every anal reference, I'm going up on your shoulder.
I know, I'm pushing you away. Okay. It's cool, it down. Yeah.
If you took every single one of those out, he'd have a supporting role, not a starring
role.
That
happens to be the way he talks. It happens to be the way some high school kids talk. This movie is funny.
I mean, there's no arguing with Roger's statement. He's 100% right. And I love when you see Gene get all worked up, because he can tell that he's getting backed into a corner. And so he starts just pulling excuses out of his ass. And he's got nowhere to go with it, and he knows he's got nowhere to go with it. And it gets better in the next segment. But yeah, Roger's 100% right. It's a funny movie. It's relevant for teenagers. And you and I have talked about this before, offline and on the show. There are films that are not made for all audiences, right? Like, Oppenheimer was not meant for 12-year-olds, but it's going to win Best Picture, right? Like, I hate the excuse that Gene uses so often, where it's like, it has to be likable across the board, or it's not a good movie. And this is not that case. This is a movie for teenagers. Yeah, parents might chuckle at it. I think it's funny that we're parents now and we think it's hilarious, and my kid would probably be bored. You know, it's written for different generations. And cinema appreciators like them, I feel, sometimes miss the boat where they compare contemporary film with something from 30, 40 years earlier. It's like, you can't do that. It's a different generation now. We got different standards and we got different things that make us laugh. And this is like one of the high watermarks of the 80s of like outlandish teenage sci-fi stupid comedy. But Roger gets it. He gets what they're doing here.
And Roger was ready to go. I mean, it's almost contrary to what we're saying, where he overanalyzed it. And I'm saying that he underanalyzed it. But I love it when, especially this episode, where he gets so flustered that it got Gene to say anal like three times over and over again. So he doesn't know what to say because he doesn't really know how to analyze this movie, because he has no objection other than one character and his foul mouth. And our critics are probably going to get into it here in a second. And that's it. That's the dialogue on one singular character. And then we put that on top of the sexism that he didn't really prove his point. So he's really not going anywhere. And Roger knows it.
And they finish it off in good fashion.
The scene where they invent, when they program the computer is funny. The scene where the woman appears is funny. The way she talks to them is
That's
funny.
That's the first five
it
minutes of the movie.
One of the things that Hughes knows in this movie, mm-hmm. and he knows in all of his movies, is how high school kids think. And of course, you said it was sexist. I guess it is sexist. Some high school kids are sexist. They have this woman. What do they do with her? I think it was fabulous that she turned out to have a mind of her own and that she tries to help them grow up instead of simply being a Playboy centerfold.
No, I think it would have been
very interesting.
I think it would have been more fun, frankly, if it had gotten out of control with their and they had learned the lesson on their own without her turning the character. But Roger, this script is full of it goes to toilet humor.
Like they sounded like the parents committee.
No, I'm not like the parents committee. I like the howling when it came to vampire films, and I like all kinds of crazy teenage films, uh-huh. and this one is
garbage. Your credentials are terrific, but you missed the boat on this one.
Well, first of all, The Howling is a werewolf film, Gene, not a vampire film. Anyway, he's 100% right. Roger, you can't say that he was like a stiff. He did appreciate movies like this. They both hated She's Out of Control, and we both said that She's Out of Control is as close to an emulation of a John Hughes movie that I think I've seen from the 80s, but they didn't see the sincerity in it. Neither of them did, but Roger sees it in this one, and he's right. Like, teenage boys are kind of inherently sexist. They look at women in a certain way because they don't understand women yet. All they understand is their mom, and they don't have any sexual feelings for their mom. Well, most don't. I'm not going to have a Freudian conversation here, but it's like a toy that you want, but you can't touch or can't have. And so you're just trying to figure out what's the closest way you can get to experiencing this toy. That's a teenage boy's frame of mind. That's not mine. But that's how this is written, because the respect they gain for Lisa and the maturity that they get later on the film when they realize they don't need her anymore. It's not that they don't want her. They just don't need her. And so if they don't need her anymore, then she should be allowed to do what she wants and be free and not attached to them. That's a very mature message at the end of this movie. It's not like Harry and the Hendersons where they have to slap her and punch her in the face to get her to walk away into the woods. She knew the end game from the very beginning. So it shows that Lisa had the intelligence and the foresight of what she needed to do with these boys. And then once they realized they had it, they don't need her anymore. When you said the word sweet earlier, that's exactly what that is. That is like such a sweet moment of this crazy comedy that brings us back to the heart that John Hughes was so well known for.
I think Gene at this point, he reminds me of Gary's dad, and there is a similar look to him in this movie where he is
the sweater vest under the sports coat.
And he has that stickler to him, and he even says it is, why do we even need the Lisa? Why can't they learn on their own? Because there wouldn't be a movie. That would be 16 Candles. That would be Breakfast Club. That's a whole different learning lesson. The whole premise of this movie is to have the symbolic female teach them the facts of life, if you will. for a 97-minute runtime, whatever it may be, and take them through those steps of confidence. Because like you said, in the movie shows, we don't have parents that relate to their kids, or they're not there. This is a symbolic genie that is going to grant the wish of them growing up. And by the end of it, they learn a moral lesson, and Gene won't even recognize the climax and the arc of learning that lesson. And it's not treating Lisa as an object. It's them going off as adults, or a step closer to being adults, I should say. And that's the whole premise. How, as a critic, do you miss the final 10 minutes of it summing it up for you of what these two boys learned? That's where it's apparent that he's missed the boat.
Well, it's not only what the boys learned either.
That's true.
It's what everyone learns. It's what the other teenagers at the party learn. It's what the two girls who were previously dating the douchebags learn. They're like, oh my God, like Robert Ressler and Robert Downey Jr. are immature little boys. And then these two nerds that we thought were immature little boys are actually stand-up guys that we can see ourselves with. So there's maturity in that aspect as well. And then Chet, too. Like, Chet kind of has an interesting redemption as well after he gets, you know, turned into a toad. You can tell in that end part where, like, Chet does have a love for Wyatt, but because he's was probably a neglected child raised by maids and then military school, he had no one to take that angst out on other than his little brother. And I've seen that in real life with people, with brothers doing that to younger brothers, you know? Sisters with younger sisters, too. Like, there is a lot of truth to that. So, yeah, at the end of the day, as wacky and as fantastical as this movie is, it's a reason why it's number two on my list of favorite John Hughes movies. But also, like, if the reputation that comes with it for people who haven't necessarily seen it, they just know the premise, I'm just going to say just watch it. And watch it all the way to the end. Because if you only watch it halfway, you might feel the way that Gene does, because that is what it has to set up in order for the rest of the story to work out. And that is the beauty of this movie, is that it's crazy, but it's got a heart and it's got a message at the end.
Yeah, and I'm going to just say, don't judge a book by its cover, because a lot of the marketing is the wrong type of cover. Because when you go into this expecting something, you're going to be looking and be hooked on this expectation of looking for something in this movie. It is a pleasant surprise if you go into it looking at just the characters and let them take you on the journey of what they're going through. Because that's where the magic happens. It's not the special effects. It's not all the chaotic stuff that I said kind of distracts it towards the end. But follow the characters and keep your eyes on these characters, on their behavior, because there is a bigger message that they want to tell. And John Hughes is telling throughout this story. But if you go in expecting a sex comedy, it's not going to be that per se. And just to take on one last thing with Gene is, when it comes to sexism with teenagers, and you said it, there is nothing wrong with presenting that on a screen, as long as there's a lesson and way to take us on a journey. Because when we don't talk about it, or we don't have this subject matter in cinema or books or whatever it may be, to really open up the conversation, that's when we get those characters like Gary's father that really constrain the conversational piece. And we get behavioral issues that we kind of see kind of pop up with Gary trying to learn who he is sexually. So to me, I think there is a bigger piece of it that people just need to really open up their minds and their eyes to this movie.
Yeah, so it's funny because I think we are now on another episode where I have to give Gene an F on his review. Like, it's just a bad review because he's going from a place of, and I can't even say morality because it's false. It's not sincere. The fact that he loved Blame It on Rio and gave it a thumbs up, but he has disdain for this movie. And I gave him an F on that episode, too. So there is something about the sincerity. Even if your sincerity is wrong in the court of public opinion, at least you were clear with your message and how you actually felt about something, and you can hold on to your credibility as a critic. When you decide to be way too contradictory with your opinion based on your sense of false morality, that's when you lose credibility as a critic for me. Roger's guilty too, but not nearly as often as Gene. And this is a perfect example.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And when it comes to Roger, this is what I liked about his review is, one, he doesn't give too much, like my complaint of the last couple of episodes. And he tends to go more on the defense here to defend this movie, which I would have loved to see more thought put into. What he says, more specific examples that his review, written review, does go into. I think with his arguments, they counter Gene's very well to really entice me to want to go see this movie and make a decision for myself, because he kind of gives points of view that really kind of stops Gene in his tracks to kind of say, hang on one second, you're overthinking this. You're missing the point of it. So to me, I think Roger did a respectable job. I would give him a solid 3 stars on this one.
I would have liked to have heard his review as well had Gene not been so, you know, aggravated by it. Like if this would have been like a more complimentary between the two of them where they both kind of like the movie, and then they could have talked about more instead of just Roger having to go on the defense from all the things that Gene was throwing out. So as much as I love that review, I would have loved to have heard a more constructive conversation about the movie and less of a debate. That's just me. Awesome, awesome. Well, great movie, great conversation. So, you know, it's time for my pick, and I'm bringing an Antonio pick to the show. But you've brought some of your picks too, so I don't see that it's like that big of a deal. I'm bringing a New World's Picture classic starring Donna Wilkes, Rory Calhoun, Susan Tyrell. I'm bringing 1983's Angel, classic of the sleazecore LA street dramas. And I can't wait to talk about this one. I'm already excited, so you know I like the movie, but I haven't watched their review of it yet. So I'm really curious to see what their thoughts were, because generally, these aren't the kind of movies they like. So I'm really excited to see what they have to say about it.
I'm with you. I haven't seen the review. I've seen the movie, but I'm going to be reserved. I want it to be a surprise for you.
Right. Well, because it's my pick. You need to be reserved.
But I will be curious on what they think of this. I'm going to pull it up right now after this show.
So, everyone, thank you for watching, listening, and please like, subscribe, review, rate 5 stars on all your favorite pod platforms on YouTube. Please reach out to us and give us suggestions if there's any films you want us to cover. As long as they were covered by Siskel and Ebert on their show, we will do them. I'm not going to ask you to hurt us anymore. I think I got that point across. Just send us something. And you can always find me, Antonio, at thecultworthy.com for all of my blogs, podcasts, reviews, and collaborations. Justin, where can people find you?
You can also find me at themoviewire.com.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.